focus on the issue of intelligence. A lot of the lecture will focus on the theory of multiple intelligences and my own view of it today, but I want to both begin with a more general discussion of how intelligence has been conceptualized in psychology, and then I want to end with some speculations about what I think is going to happen to the study of intelligence in the future. I'm going to begin with what's called the old or narrow view of intelligence. And this goes back to the beginning beginning of the 20th century, to the work of Alfred Binet. Now, actually, Alfred Binet would have been called a cognitive developmental psychologist today. He was very interested in human development and very interested in thinking. And in fact, like Piaget, actually studied his own children and wrote quite interestingly about them. But Binet was approached at the start of the century by the Ministry of Education in Paris. And this was a time when a lot of people were migrating to Paris, from both from other countries and from the provinces, and some of them were having a lot of trouble in school. You may recognize that this is not a situation that is unique to Paris in 1900. And Binet had a very clever idea. He said, let's see if we can come up with some kind of a measure, some kind of a test, which will predict which kids have trouble in school. And he approached this challenge in a completely empirical way. He gave lots and lots of questions to lots and lots of kids of different ages, and he saw which questions, when correctly answered, predict success in school, and which questions, when wrongly answered, predicted failure in school at various ages. And he got rid of all the other questions. He wasn't interested in the ones everybody could pass, and he wasn't interested in the ones everybody failed. He was interested in the ones which differentiated better students from worse students. And without knowing it, because these things don't happen in one moment, Binet had created the first intelligence test, and shortly afterwards, a way of scoring the test called the IQ was devised by a German named Stern. And the IQ, as you probably know, is simply the ratio between your mental age and your chronological age. So if you're smarter than you should be, and the ratio is, let's say, 12 to 10, then your IQ is 100 because you multiply the figure by 100. If you are stupider than you're supposed to be at your age, if you're chronologically 10, but you're only scoring like an 8-year-old, then your IQ is 80. Very ingenious idea. Sometimes I quip that it was unnecessary, because if you want to know how kids are going to do in school next year, just look at last year's grades. It's a much, much more reliable predictor. But somehow it doesn't quite satisfy our desire for efficiency and economy and numbers. And therefore, the Binet approach in its various iterations and transformations has been the approach people have used throughout the last century. The next slide shows Lewis Terman, who was a psychologist at Stanford for many years, early in the century. And what Stanford did was take the French IQ test from the first decade of the new century, the 20th century, and Americanized it. He created something which he called the Stanford-Binet test. You now know the reason for why it's called the Stanford-Binet. And the Stanford-Binet was a norm test. You could compare every child's performance to everybody else's performance. And it was a test with a clear manual which told you exactly how many points to give for every student's response. And it was easily transformable into multiple choice or paper and pencil form, though Stanford-Binet is still ideally administered in a person-to-person, hands-on kind of way. Terman was very convinced that IQ, the measure of intelligence, was a tremendously important figure. He believed that people were born with a certain intelligence, couldn't be changed. And in fact, he studied 1,500 kids who lived in California shortly after the turn of the century, all of whom had very high IQs. And he figured these were the smarties. They're now called the Termites. They're in their 80s, and they've been studied throughout the century. So we know a tremendous amount about these high IQ scoring kids. It's interesting to know that probably the two most amazing people in California at the time did not pass Terman's hurdle. That was Richard Nixon, who of course became president and also was the only president to ever resign, and William Shockley, who won a Nobel Prize for inventing the transistor, and then became an expert in IQ and a believer that it was the only thing that mattered, and a founder of eugenics movement. There's a Shockley sperm bank to this day where you can donate your sperm if you're considered to be worthy enough. He died in some disgrace. Maybe he was angry that Terman never included him in the sample. On the other hand, the sample has lots of psychologists in it, and that may be that may not be an accident. I think the IQ test is the kind of test a psychologist would make. And clearly, if you were dubbed by Terman as one of the elite, you'd be highly motivated to contribute to the perpetuation of your species. So there are several psychologists, famous psychologists, who were part of the Terman sample. What's interesting to me as an observer is the technology of IQ and the way it's measured has not changed very much in the course of an entire century. And this was brought home by the fact that there are people like Hans Eysenck, the most famous psychologist in England, who believed that you could dispense with the intelligence test and simply put a kind of a hair dryer on your head with lots of electrical leads on it, and you could measure people's IQ that way. So you kind of cut out the middleman of the paper and pencil of the problems, puzzles to solve, and just measure the intelligence directly. And then in a book which gained a lot of notoriety a few years ago called The Bell Curve, The Bell Curve takes the view of intelligence which we've had throughout the Binet, Terman, Eysenck century, the 20th century, namely that there's a single thing called intelligence. We're born with it. We can't change it very much. It's in our genes. And psychologists, be they Binet or Terman or Eysenck, can tell us how smart we are by giving us a test. If it's Binet, it's a hands-on test where you have to point to something that's wrong in a picture or repeat numbers backwards or solve an analogy or remember a passage. If it's Eysenck, it's simply seeing how quickly you respond to something when it's presented to you and looking at the pattern of brain waves. But the idea is always the same. It's the search for the key to figuring out how smart you are. And even people like me who do not accept this theory either on a scientific basis or on a policy level as something that we should, so to speak, do to people, have a great deal of difficulty getting away from these ideas about intelligence because there's so much in our culture, the notion that you got a certain amount of smarts and we can tell you how much you have, and once we do, your fate is more or less determined. Since we're in education class, it's worth mentioning that before Herrnstein died, he and I talked about the bell curve, and he agreed that you could take the conclusions in the bell curve and you could come to exactly the opposite educational conclusions. The conclusion of the bell curve is that intelligence is hard to change. And there have been efforts to change intelligence, and it is hard to change. Now, the conclusion that Herrnstein and Murray draw is since intelligence is hard to change, don't bother. And the social burden of the argument in the bell curve is that we're going to have societies of smarties and not-so-smarties and dummies, and we may as well accept that kind of society, which is why the book was a controversial book. It was even more controversial because it suggested genetic bases for racial differences in intelligence. But Herrnstein agreed with me, and not even uncivilly. He said, sure, if it's hard to change, we could decide to spend all our efforts trying to change intelligence. So this is important because it says you can never go from a scientific finding, namely it's difficult to do something, to a policy conclusion, because you can either conclude, since it's difficult to do something, let's not try, or since it's difficult to do, but important, we should devote all our efforts. From my point of view, and this point is missed by almost everybody, it's pointless to try to change IQ per se. What you really want to try to change are performances that matter. So let's say the IQ test involves repeating numbers backwards and finding errors in pictures. Now, you could spend a lot of time trying to train people to do that, and undoubtedly they would get better. Not even Herrnstein and Murray would dispute that. But if you don't particularly value repeating numbers backwards or finding errors in pictures, it's a waste of time. You say, well, what's not a waste of time? And I would say, well, learning to read, learning to write, learning to calculate, learning to understand history and think historically. And if in doing that your IQ gets better, great. But let's not sit around and train people in repeating numbers backwards. There's also a very important phenomenon which everybody in this field needs to know, and it's one that gave Herrnstein and Murray a lot of difficulty. It's called the Flynn effect, named after an Australian psychologist. I think his first name is John Flynn. And Flynn made an amazing discovery, which nobody disputes. The discovery is that every 10 years, IQ goes up about 3 points around the world. That means in 50 years, not even a lifetime, the IQ goes up a standard deviation. That's huge. That means from 100, which is absolutely average, to 115, which is pretty good. Or from 85, which is borderline retarded, to 100, which is perfectly okay. And this happens all the way around the world. The IQ goes up about 15 points every year. How dramatic this is relates to the racial difference. The black-white difference in America, not in other countries, interestingly, but the black-white difference in America has been consistently about 15 points, one standard deviation, ever since they began to do those measures. However, because IQ as a whole goes up 3 points every 10 years, what this means is the white IQ in 1950 is about what the black IQ is in 2000. So if you could erase the time difference, there's no difference between black and white IQ. Of course, you can't, and so the difference persists. But why, if IQ is in your genes, it should go up 3 points every 10 years is a fascinating question. Herrnstein and Murray say it has to do with diet, and that once everybody is well-fed, there'll no longer be a Flynn effect, maybe. My own notion, which is no more exotic than theirs, is that it has to do with the amount of time you spend in school. Basically, the IQ is a measure of how well you will do in school. As more people go to school and spend more time in schools, they become more familiar with IQ items, and so over the course of a 10-year period, the IQ will go up 3 points. The conclusion of this is that when everybody is completely familiar with school, then the IQ will cease going up. Anyway, we will, over time, discover what it is that causes the Flynn effect. But clearly, the Flynn effect is a real obstacle for people who want to say that intelligence is completely genetically determined, because if it is, it shouldn't change no matter what, whether it's going to school or diet or anything else like that. That point could be unpacked, but the basic point is nobody predicted the Flynn effect, and yet it stares us in the face. Anyway, about 25 years ago, in the late 1970s, I began to develop a new view about intelligence. And this view was different from other views in that it really did not pay much attention to the whole idea of creating tests and measuring intelligence. Not because I think that's a bad idea, but just because it wasn't where I was coming from, so to speak. Where I was coming from were lots of studies of human development and human breakdown after conditions of brain damage. I've been studying stroke victims and noticing the kinds of abilities which get compromised when you have various different kinds of brain lesions. As you may know, the biggest thing about a brain lesion is not how big it is, but where it is. And depending on where in your left or right hemisphere, whether you're on the surface or deep, whether you're left or right, whether you're anterior or posterior, depending on where the damage is, you will lose different kinds of abilities. And this does not square with the standard view of intelligence as one thing which people have more or less of. At the same time, I was working with all kinds of kids, normal kids, gifted kids, kids with different kinds of pathology. And over again, I was discovering kids who were not kind of even across the board, so to speak, 115 IQ in everything or 85 IQ in everything, but rather kids who were strong in some areas, average in other areas, and weak in third areas. And again, that does not comport with a standard IQ view of intelligence. So what I did, unlike other researchers in the area of intelligence, was a lot of synthesizing of various kinds of information. What we know about the brain and how it develops and how it's organized in people. What we know about the evolution of the species. We actually know a lot more about the evolution of the species in the beginning of the 21st century than we did in the 1970s, but I use whatever data we had about different species and what kinds of intellectual capacities they had or lacked. I studied different kinds of special populations, prodigies, autistic avants, individuals with learning disabilities, deficits. And then I paid a lot of attention to the kinds of abilities which are valued not just in America circa 2000, but that were valued much earlier in our own country, or that were valued in different cultures and in different historical eras. So rather than paying a lot of attention to what Robert Reich calls the symbol analyst, which is what is valued on Wall Street today, I thought equally about what it takes to lead a community, what it takes to heal somebody who's sick, physically or psychologically, what it takes to be an effective performer, a navigator, a surgeon, a craftsperson, a negotiator. And the more I began to think about these different kinds of end states, as I call them, the clearer it became to me that there was no way in which a standard IQ test could tell you whether a person would succeed in all of these different pursuits. And in fact, they can't. The more something is like school, the better a predictor an IQ test is. And the less it's like school, the less good predictor it is of whether you'll succeed in that particular pursuit. This is, in a sense, a struggle about who gets to define what intelligence is. And as I've already indicated, psychologists have gotten to define it, and we have to thank Binet and Terman and Eysenck for that. But let's say the intelligence tests have been developed by business people, and they valued risk-taking and entrepreneurship and projecting trends of customers' tastes figuring out how to negotiate and how to deceive somebody in a negotiation. These are all very important things in business. There's no way that you can tell from a person's IQ whether they can do any of these things. In fact, there's only one thing you can predict for sure from a person's IQ, and that's whether he can get into Mensa or whether she can get into Mensa. Mensa is an organization where you have to have a certain IQ to get in. And believe it or not, there is now an organization called Super Mensa. I'm not joking. And people whose IQs are even higher than the average Mensa people get into Super Mensa. And of course, they can then congratulate one another for being in Mensa. But there's plenty of evidence that people in Mensa don't necessarily do anything very interesting in life. And we know from neuropsychological studies that a person can lose his or her frontal lobes, which basically means they sit around like a vegetable and they don't do anything. But they still have an IQ of 150 because the IQ tests a lot of what's called crystallized knowledge, like, you know, who wrote the Iliad and you know, what's the meaning of chromium and things like that. And that doesn't get lost when you have you lose your frontal lobes. So the more we begin to look at the world and what's valued there, and the less we look at what it takes to succeed in a certain kind of school, the more the IQ approach does seem to be narrow in the sense I was using earlier. Anyway, I have a definition of what an intelligence is, and let me unpack that definition. First of all, it's a biological potential. What that means is because we're a certain kind of species, and because we have certain genes and a certain neural structure, we have certain kinds of potentials, and we don't have other ones. We don't have the potential to fly by ourselves, though we do have the potential to build devices which will fly. These potentials allow us to process information. That's a psych word. It basically means there's lots, all kinds of information in the world. There's visual information, there's tactile information, there's linguistic information, there's musical information. And by argument, we've got little computers in our head that can process that kind of information. So this is both a biological argument, we're a certain kind of species, and it's an information processing argument. We've got little computers in our head that when they run into space or music can do the requisite computations. Why? Because we want to be able to solve problems or to make things, to fashion products that are valued in a culture or community. Everybody agrees that intelligence involves problem solving. Psychologists agree particularly because the only thing we know how to study is when people can solve problems. But making stuff, writing a symphony, developing a psychological theory or a scientific theory, designing a building, running a meeting, teaching well, these are all products which we value in our society, and I think intelligence needs to be able to make attention to that as well. A little offhand remark, the kinds of things which usually don't get into videoed lectures, and people who don't like video lectures miss, is I recently met the Polish translator of one of my books, And he said, you know, I'm having a great deal of trouble translating into Polish the phrase fashion products. And I said, my God, they must think I'm talking about selling dresses. But yeah, it's just, I said, I'm sorry, it's just an American idiom that has nothing really to do with fashion. But you could see how the translator could have gotten thrown by that. This is a very different kind of definition of intelligence than is usually put forth. And part of it is because I believe that intelligence isn't something that would always emerge under every condition. Rather, we live in certain cultures or communities which have things or don't have things like computers or literacy or big organizations to run. And whether they have those things depends and determines whether we develop certain abilities and whether they're valued. And presumably there are all kinds of potentials humans have which have never even valued or they've never been made use of, and so we don't call them intellectual. However, if a device is invented, like a computer or a compass or a blackboard or whatever, and then it teases out people who are good at using that kind of device and becomes to value, lo and behold, we then begin to call that intelligence. And similarly, books get invented, and suddenly people who can remember everything become oddities, because there's no need to remember everything, you can look it up. And when computers get smart enough to be able to solve all of our military and economic and political problems, people who could have done those before will be useless, and people who can, you know, dance in new ways may be more valuable. So this is a culturally relative definition in the sense that it's what I call a critique of the dipstick theory. The dipstick theory says you want to know how much oil you have in your car, you stick your dipstick in, you pull it out, it says, oh, you need a pint. The cortical dipstick theory says you wonder how smart somebody is. You stick in the cortical dipstick, you look at it, you say, oh, 123 IQ, you'll probably get to go to college and, you know, maybe be able to be an accountant or something like that. I don't believe that. I believe that who gets to be called smart is going to change a lot, and that there is no such thing as a test that's really culture-free. So if you really wanted to know about people's intelligences, you'd have to have lots of different kinds of tests from lots of different kinds of cultures, because any single test is going to have a lot of biases built into it. That's my definition. When I originally wrote about the different intelligences, I postulated that there were 7. There's been a bit of inflation since then, and I now think that there are 8 or 9 different intelligences, and I'm going to run through them rather quickly because this is available easily in your reading, and say a bit more about the intelligences, which I haven't written so much about. In each case, I will talk about people who sort of exemplify each intelligence, so all of us have all of the intelligences. That's what's fun about this. So the first intelligence is called linguistic. That's a famous Chinese poet named Li Po. Anybody who traffics a lot in language, whether it's a lawyer or a writer or an orator, would have a lot of linguistic intelligence, but poets kind of stand out because they really do live in the world of words. I took a course with the poet Robert Lowell, who, when a person used a word, would tell you how every poet in the English language used that word. His mind was like a cross between the thesaurus and the Norton's anthology of English literature, and that's a really well-organized linguistic intelligence. Second kind of intelligence is logical-mathematical. The intelligence of the mathematician, the logician, the computer programmer, the scientist. Important point, Piaget thought he was studying all of intelligence, and Piaget actually trained in the laboratory of Simon, who was Binet's partner. So there's an intellectual lineage here in the study of intelligence. As you may remember, Piaget became uninterested in what scores kids got and very interested in the errors they made and what that reflected about their thinking. Anyway, Piaget was really studying logical mathematical intelligence, and toward the very end of his life, not due to anything I had to say on the subject, he began to realize that intelligence was much more domain-specific than he had recognized. But the important point is that in our society today, language and logic are very important. Nobody would dispute that. They're even more important in school, and they're even most important in taking certain kinds of tests. If you've got the right blend of language logic, in Cambridge we call it the Alan Dershowitz blend of language logic, you will do very well in any kind of a paper and pencil test. Indeed, to do well in the SAT, which is basically an IQ test, William F. Buckley, the conservative commentator, said you don't have to know what the right answer is. You have to know what the schnook who made up the question thought the right answer was. And that's a wonderful way of thinking about intelligence tests, because there's definitely, as the French would say, a mentalité involved in making up tests. And I know myself as a good test taker that I often could figure out the right answer even though I was clueless about the topic because I knew how to eliminate choices. That's a kind of useful ability to have, but it's not necessarily a measure of what purports to be a measure. But anyway, there's a reason why we focus on language and logic, but it's not a sufficient reason to ignore the other intelligences, which include musical intelligence. Now, many people say, well, music's a talent. It's not an intelligence. I say, all right, well, let's say that people who are talented with notes and harmonies and rhythms are talented. But then let's call people who are good with words and metaphors talented with language, and people who are good with numbers and equations talented with math. Why prioritize, foreground one intellectual capacity and not another? We could say in our culture today, maybe logic is more important, and maybe 500 years ago language is more important, and maybe 500 years from now music will be more important. But I object to the notion of a priori saying one is an intelligence and one's a talent, because they're just different kind of computational skills. Fourth kind of intelligence is spatial intelligence, and it's a useful one to make the point that if you have a lot of a certain kind of intelligence for whatever reason, and you'll see later I don't make genetic or non-genetic arguments about this, that suggests the kind of things you do. If you're going to be an artist, you're probably more likely to be a sculptor or a painter than a composer or a poet. If you're going to be a scientist, you're probably more likely to be an anatomist than a particle physicist. In a profession, you're more likely to be an architect than an accountant. So the spatial intelligence suggests from the range of choices which ones you're likely to gravitate to. Similarly, with bodily kinesthetic intelligence, the intelligence of the dancer, the athlete, this causes people to put it down until I say the surgeon or the craftsman or something goes wrong with their computer or anything else or their car and there's something they want, somebody can fix it, and then bodily kinesthetic intelligence goes up in their estimation. Two kinds of personal intelligence, interpersonal intelligence, that's of course a famous religious leader and politician, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., but anybody who's in the realm of dealing with other people, as a teacher, a clinician, a salesperson, business person, religious person, would be trafficking with interpersonal intelligence. Its complement is intrapersonal intelligence, understanding of yourself, having a good working model of who you are, what your strengths and weaknesses are, what you're trying to accomplish, how you can or fail to accomplish that. And even though nobody really quite understands interpersonal intelligence well, it's clearly very important because in times past, people did what their forebears did, their ancestors. But nowadays, people have to make their own decisions about career, where to live, who to live with, when to make a change, what to do when you're re-engineered or downsized. And if you don't have a good sense of yourself, you can have a high Q of 500 and embark in lots of disastrous paths. Conversely, if you have a good understanding of yourself, what you can and can't do, and how to use other kinds of aid, then you can be an extremely productive human being. So interpersonal intelligence, though we don't understand it well and don't know how we would assess it, is very important. When I first thought about inter and intrapersonal intelligence, these were very difficult for critics to swallow, but I got a great boost from Dan Goleman, who wrote a tremendous bestseller called Emotional Intelligence. Last count, it sold over 5 million copies. And unlike The Bell Curve, which nobody's ever read, people actually do read the book Emotional Intelligence, Goleman is actually talking very much about what I'm talking about when I talk about the personal intelligences, and he and I agree about that. I'd be happy to take 1/100th of his royalties. There's an eighth intelligence, which I'm quite convinced is a genuine one. It fulfills the criteria for intelligence, which are drawn from biology, psychology, and anthropology. It fulfills those criteria quite comfortably. The naturalist intelligence is the intelligence that allows us to make consequential distinctions in the natural world. Tell one cloud from another, one rock from another, one fern or plant from another, one lizard or salamander from another. Obviously, it's very, very important for survival throughout human prehistory and for those of us who are still, you know, botanists or farmers. But I also think the naturalist intelligence has gotten hijacked, so to speak, by our consumer world, where the same cognitive capacities which allow us to distinguish one subspecies from another allow us to distinguish one sneaker or one automobile or one wallet from another. So naturalist intelligence is quite useful in the world of commerce, the world of business. Charles Darwin is somebody who was clearly an expert in naturalist intelligence. It's interesting, when Darwin was young, he thought he was stupid. It's hard for us nowadays to believe that probably the most important scientist of the 19th century thought that he was stupid. But Darwin came from a very intellectual family, and there were a lot of people there who were a lot more mathematical and more logical than he was. And he kind of took the definition, which his cousin, Francis Galton, a name whom you should know, and who was actually a predecessor of Binet, he took the, you know, this facility with mathematics as what it meant to be smart. And indeed, Huxley, who became Darwin's bulldog, who toured the British Isles defending Darwin's theory when Darwin was too shy to do that, said, "Oh, it's such a simple idea, why didn't I think of it?" And that what Huxley meant was, "I'm sure I have 20 IQ points, though there was no IQ yet, I'm sure I got 20 IQ points in Darwin, but how did he come up with this?" And the answer is complicated, but the naturalist intelligence was certainly very important for Darwin. A lot of people had speculated that there might be a spiritual intelligence. In fact, a fair number of people had said that Howard Gardner says there's a spiritual intelligence, but that was not true. I'd never said that. And indeed, the more I examined what people called spiritual, the more convinced I became that whatever it is, it's not an intelligence. And for those of you who want to pursue that further, there's a chapter in Intelligence Reframed where I give my reasons for accepting naturalist intelligence but not spiritual intelligence. In the process of thinking about this, however, I became convinced there might be an existential intelligence, which I call the intelligence of big questions. The human intelligence which allows us to think about things which are too big or too small to perceive. The universe, God, the cosmos. Questions like, who are we? Why are we here? What's going to happen to us? These are really big questions. They're questions about existence. I think they may be a form of human intelligence. But the reason I'm pausing at 8.5 rather than 9 intelligences is because I like to have evidence that there are parts of the brain that are dedicated to this kind of information processing rather than existential intelligence being simply a combination, say, of logical, mathematical, and linguistic, and intrapersonal. But I think there may be an existential intelligence, and so informally I begin to talk about it, but I haven't quite allowed it to enter the circle of the officially endorsed intelligences. This theory makes a number of claims, and actually the claims that it has changed over the years, so the theory has its own life, it's evolved, so to speak. The first claim is all of us have these intelligences. That's what makes us a human being in a cognitive sense. Rats may have more spatial intelligence, bluebirds may have more musical intelligence, hummingbirds may. My computer, my laptop's got a lot more logical mathematical intelligence than I do, but they don't have existential intelligence and they don't have intrapersonal intelligence. We're a species that, because of our biological heritage, has these intelligences. Yet, no two of us, not even identical twins, have exactly the same profiles of intelligence for both genetic and environmental reasons. In fact, you can do a functional MRI of twins, identical twins, processing language, and they will do it in different ways for reasons we could speculate about. So the intelligences vary across people, just as personality and temperament does. And that's where things become interesting educationally. The third point is when we talk about somebody acting intelligently, or more commonly, acting stupidly, and I include myself in both categories, we're not talking about computing power. A person can have a tremendous computer in his or her head. They can have 8 or 9 computers. But I don't think you can talk about somebody acting intelligently unless you take into account goals and values, the person's goals and values, and the goals and values of the larger society. So the same act can be considered intelligent or stupid, depending on what you're trying to achieve and whether that makes sense in your particular culture. Let's say I gave the rest of the lecture twice as fast. Would that be intelligent or stupid? all depends on what I'm trying to achieve. You can't answer that question apart from having a set of goals and values. And that's that applies to any significant act of a person. You have to be able to examine it against the background to determine whether it's intelligent or not. I produced this work as a psychologist addressed to other psychologists, but to my surprise, it turned out to be more interesting to educators. Psychologists usually didn't like the theorists, though some did. Biologists tended to be more sympathetic to it, but educators found it fascinating, and I've reflected a lot about why that's the case. But I think one reason why it's the case is because I didn't really make any educational recommendations. I didn't think at the time very much about education. So MI theory, as it's become called almost universally, I don't remember actually who created the term MI theory. I might have been, I just don't remember, has become an inkblot. Educators look at MI theory and they draw all kinds of inferences from the theory, even though it's not in the theory. It's a projection on the theory, just like when you look at an inkblot and you say it's two people hugging each other or two people strangling one another, it's neither. It's just an inkblot, but you're projecting a meaning onto it. So people say, oh, seven or eight intelligences, let's create seven or eight tests, or let's create seven or eight curricula, or let's teach everything seven or eight different ways, or let's put all the kids who are smart in one intelligence together, or let's put all the kids who are dumb in one intelligence together, or let's mix and match them like an omelet. And none of that's in the theory. So the theory gives people a lot of running room, and I think that's one reason why it's been attractive in education. And that's not to denigrate educators. I think there are other reasons as well, which I'll come to in a moment. Let me also say, though, that while initially I had no particular educational agenda in writing about multiple intelligences, colleagues at Project Zero and I, over the last 20 years, have done a lot of work on the educational implications of the theory, and there now are several books, both by me and by other people at Project Zero, which talk about project work based on multiple intelligences, multiple intelligences in particular curricular areas, including history, science, the arts, creating environments which nurture multiple intelligences, like children's museums or certain kinds of classrooms and so on. So we haven't run away from educational implications, but they really were, I guess to be honest, they were a response to demand. Other people wanted them, and again, speaking frankly, I didn't like a lot of the uses other people were making. And both of those things drove my colleagues and me to devise our own multiple intelligences approaches. And my colleague Mindy Kornhaber has actually studied 40-some schools which have used multiple intelligences in interesting ways. And as of the year 2000 to 2001, there'll be a book about what she's discovered in her SUMMIT project, SUMMIT being an acronym for Schools Using Multiple Intelligences Theory. If I had to boil down what I think the most important educational implication of MI theory is, it's the notion of taking differences among individuals very seriously. If you believe in a bell curve view and that all people are just smarter or dumb on a single criterion, then there's no real point in individualizing education. You just either go faster or slower depending on how much the person can pick up. But if you believe we are variations on many curves and that we have very unusual blends of intelligence, then you're faced with a stark choice. Either ignore that, treat everybody the same. And when you treat everybody the same, it sounds fair, but actually it's unfair, because it's picking one kind of mind, almost always the language logic law professor mind, and the more people are like that, the better they'll do. So it's unfair. But if you say, let's find out as much about everybody as possible, which is an assessment issue, and let's match kids up with curriculum as much as possible, and that's a pedagogy issue, and let's teach them in ways which are appropriate, then you have to take individual differences seriously. And that's what we've tried to do in our educational approaches. So far, I've given you a little background on the standard view of intelligence. There are, of course, many details in various people's views, and I couldn't go into those today. And I've given you some intellectual background about MI theory, how it grew out of a number of different disciplines rather than just out of test-taking and test-making, which is the usual background growing out of Binet and Terman and their successors. And then I've told you the major claim that there's these intelligences. We've all got them, but we differ in the blends, and we differ in how we use them, whether we use them smartly or not so smartly. Also, over the years, a whole slew of myths about multiple intelligences have arisen. I'm not going to tell you all of them, but I'm going to tell you some of them. For example, myth number two is that MI theory is not empirical. That means it's not based on data. Sometimes people also say that it's empirical and it's been disproved. It's interesting, sometimes people say both things, which shows that they're not very logical and mathematical, since they can't both be correct. What's the reality? The reality is that it's based entirely on empirical evidence. It's based on a synthesis of hundreds and hundreds of different studies drawn from many, many different disciplines, and science is a synthetic as well as an experimental science. Moreover, it can also be tested experimentally. A recent example which many people are interested in is the claim that music and spatial abilities are closely aligned, and indeed that if you listen to music, it might make you smarter spatially. This is the work of Frances Rauscher and her colleagues. I've become very intrigued about this claim for many reasons, and one reason is that if, in fact, musical and spatial intelligences are very closely connected, then I would need to rethink whether they really are separate intelligences. I'm not ready to do that yet, but I might be. And that shows you, I hope, that this is a theory that responds to new data. The naturalist intelligence was a response to discoveries that there are parts of our brain that are particularly dedicated to the naming and the recognition of what are called natural kinds, stuff that exists in the world of nature rather than stuff that we build out of plastic, which is man-made stuff. And so the theory is an empirical theory, despite what some others say. Another myth, which is probably the most important one to understand, because I was susceptible to it myself, is the myth that intelligence is the same as a domain or discipline. A domain or discipline is any area of accomplishment in a culture where you can array people in terms of how expert they are. So any art, any science, any profession, any game is a domain or discipline. Now, we talk about the intelligence of mathematics and we talk about mathematicians. So it's very easy to assume that, well, mathematicians have mathematical intelligence, musicians have musical intelligence, naturalists have naturalist intelligence. And as a first approximation, that's not entirely wrong. However, intelligences are a new kind of construct. As I said earlier, they're potential that we have. And if you've got naturalist intelligence, that doesn't mean you're going to become a naturalist. You might go work for Baskin and Robbins. And if you have a mathematical intelligence, you might end up being a poker player. You don't have to be a mathematician. Any intelligence can be applied to lots of domains. Conversely, any domain involves multiple intelligences. Musicians use musical intelligence, but they also use bodily kinesthetic intelligence and interpersonal intelligence, and indeed, they probably use all of the intelligences one way or another. So the proclivity of confusing or confounding intelligences with domains can be very risky. And here's a great question for the final exam, so I think this will wake everybody up, even the teaching fellows. And that is that we've got this brain, which God or nature gave us. We've got these intelligences, or at least Gardner thinks we have. And then we've got these domains and disciplines, which are created in various cultures. And there was no imperative that chess was invented. It was just invented over a period of years. There was no imperative that classical music was invented. It just happened to be invented. Same with parallel programming and neural nets and stuff like that. So the question is, how do we put all these together? How do we learn stuff which our brain obviously in one sense evolved to allow us to do, but it really wasn't important for survival before because it didn't exist until a few hundred years ago? This is a really deep question. And I think it's a deep question in part because people haven't asked it. I note one of our authors, Carmeloff Smith, here because of the people in developmental psychology. I think she's the closest one to ask me that question. Don't worry about Thomas. That's just there to confuse the teaching fellows. Now, another myth is that, and this is an educational myth, so those of you who come from the Ed world will immediately recognize it, and that's the claim that an intelligence is the same as a learning style or a working style or a style in general. I believe that's a misnomer. If you use the word style, what you ought to mean is the person has a way of approaching lots of different stuff, indeed, perhaps everything. So if you've got a reflective style, you should approach everything reflectively. If you've got a linear, sequential style, you should approach everything linear, sequential. If you've got a humorous style, etc. However, whether styles really do cut across the intelligences and whether they do cut across domains is an empirical question. Indeed, we have a little evidence that people might be quite reflective or linear or sequential with certain things and not with others. And my own guess is that ultimately educators will need to look at the intelligences in one dimension, one axis, and its styles in another axis, and that you may find that certain styles are connected with certain intelligences in certain people but not others. One useful bit of work on this question was done by an educationalist named Harvey Silver, who said, let's say you're very strong in intelligence like language. Your style or your personality may determine what you do within language. People who become orators tend to be extroverts, and people who are television pitch men or women. People who become poets are people who tend to be withdrawn, spend a lot of time by themselves. And so we may actually be an interaction between intellectual strength and style or personality, which determines what people do. And I think that's a useful way of thinking about these things. Another myth I've already referred to is that there's a single MI approach to education or schools. But the truth is, there's a whole variety of educational approaches. Mindy Kornhaber has cataloged some of them. And there are no official Gardner MI schools. And it's important to say that because many education reformers, like my colleagues Jim Comer and Ted Sizer, have schools which are deliberately under their influence, and you have to sign a paper and give a blood sample and things like that. I don't do anything like that. If people want to have MI or Gardner schools, that's their option, but I neither give stars or demerits to those people. I do, however, don't give a lot of stars to people who think that it's inherently good to exercise each intelligence. Let me explain what I mean by that. Often you hear that there's a school where they train the intelligences, and people say, we train all the intelligences, and I say, that's nice. But I'm really thinking is, what's the purpose? Why are you doing this? What's your goal? And it's kind of like if you had an athletic school and you said, we trained all the muscles. It's kind of useless to have lots of muscles unless you want to be on the cover of a muscle magazine. But if you're training people so they can be a good football player, or they can throw the discus well, or they can dance well, or so they're going to be healthier, that's a reason. And so if you say you're going to train intelligences, you oughtn't have kids just sort of crawling across the floor so you can train their bodily kinesthetic intelligence. You have to say, well, I want to achieve a certain role or talent. Obviously, if you want kids to be musical, you've got to train certain intelligences. If you want them to be civil human beings, you've got to train certain kinds of intelligences. So you need to have an end state or a role in mind. Or you need to have certain kind of disciplinary or interdisciplinary goals. You want kids to understand the theory of evolution, or you want them to be able to do work in genetics and economics. If you have those goals, then I think you can use the fact of multiple intelligences to help you achieve those goals. In another lecture on the ideas about understanding the disciplines and understanding the unschooled mind, I will actually talk about how we can use the fact of our multiple intelligences to train various kinds of disciplinary and interdisciplinary skills, but that's for another day. Let me just briefly mention a few other, terrible pun, mistakes. There's nothing in the theory that denies that there's such a thing as general intelligence. Something which is very beloved to most psychologists. What I question is whether predicting how well you're going to do in school should be the only thing that students of intelligence are interested in. So I question the provenance of G, not its existence. I don't have any data on how heritable these intelligences are. Heritable means if you have a population, to what extent is the differences within that population determined by who the parents, the biological parents are of the people in that population. I assume that all the intelligences have a certain heritability. If you're like G, it's probably about half, which means half the difference within a population are determined genetically and the other half by environment. But I don't know, and as I said earlier when talking about my discussion with Herrnstein, in a sense, I don't care. To me, in education, you got to deal with the deck that you're dealt. And whether someone has more or less heritable intelligence doesn't matter. If you want to learn how to read, you've just got to work hard enough so that they will learn how to read. I'm not anti-processing. What that means is that I believe each of these intelligences has its own form of information processing, but I don't, as a personal goal, want to try to describe how each intelligence works. That's for other people. This last remark is an in-joke from a lecture I gave somewhere else. I won't bother to unpack it. The general point here is that I think it's perfectly fine if people want to assess the intelligences, but I've decided I don't want to spend my time devising assessments myself. And I've written about what I think the assessment intelligences should entail, and that's something that we can discuss, or I can give you some readings on the topic. Okay, I've now gone through some myths about multiple intelligences, and I want now to turn for the last part of the talk to some of the issues which I think are going to influence or perhaps even dominate the study of intelligence in the new era. I don't have to worry about this slide going out of date as long as I'm alive, but maybe some of you long livers will have to worry about that, particularly if the genetics revolution succeeds in letting you extend your life indefinitely. But the genetics revolution is going to have influence long before that, because people will not only be in a position to do various kinds of genetic therapy on themselves, but in the position to do it on their children. I have misgivings about that in general. I have tremendous misgivings about trying to play with our kids' hair color or IQ or musical ability, but I have absolutely no doubt that unless it's made strictly illegal, people will try to do this. And obviously, once we begin to muck around with our genome, that's going to have enormous influences on how we think about intellectual issues. By the same token, as we learn more about the brain, we will actually know what's going on in the brain when various intellectual processes are being carried out. As a scholar, I find this fascinating. I'd love to be able to look at Darwin's brain in vivo and see what was going on there. When, however, we use those measures to categorize kids, to say what's not possible, or, as in the case of trying to raise IQ, just trying to change the brain waves without worrying about what people are doing, then I think it could be risky. And one of the reasons that I pushed harder than anybody at the School of Education for a mind, brain, and education initiative is because I think it's absolutely imperative for people in our field of education to know about what's going on in genetics and brain science. Without wanting to unduly castigate my colleagues, something I would never do, you cannot believe how much opposition there was in this faculty to having something in mind, brain, and education. In fact, the very last day, we almost voted out the word brain. Mind and education didn't seem to be so dangerous. Why? Because many people are frightened about brains and genetics. I might be frightened too, but I don't think the solution is to be an ostrich. I think the solution is to find out as much as possible so at least you can meet people on their own ground. The information revolution, which isn't just the World Wide Web, but will people implant silicon in our brain minds, will we download our minds into some third party so that even after our bodies go, you'll still have to deal with my bad jokes. The information revolution is going to have enormous influence on how we think about intellectual measures. And the whole notion of globalization in one world is fascinating because if you go to different cultures now, of course, they value different things, but the McDonaldization of the world could end up having an increasingly narrow kind of sense of intellect that we value. So that's another thing to monitor. These are obviously big Time magazine kind of questions, but who gets to own intelligence is a big Time magazine kind of issue. It's too important to be left to the psychometricians. Here are four issues that I think are important and that I'm working on in various ways. How broad is the concept of intelligence, and how should it be? How broad should it be? How pure contextually should we assess intelligence? Here's a subject I'm getting more interested in all the time. What happens to intelligence as we get older, the graying of intelligence? And then, is intelligence the only important thing, or are there other things we need to be worrying about in education and cognition? So let me touch on these things, and that'll conclude the lecture. I already mentioned Danny Goldman's book, Emotional Intelligence, Why It Can Matter More Than IQ. There's also Robert Coles, another Harvard colleague's book on the moral intelligence of children. If you're going to have only one intelligence, I recommend Peter Lynch's Financial Intelligence. He used to work for Fidelity. He still does ads with Whoopi Goldberg and people like that. But if points of your financial intelligence, you can buy all the rest. Barry Goldwater, a name which will be known to old people here, he ran for the president 30 years ago. He said, I don't have a Phi Beta Kappa key myself, but I hire them. And it's no doubt, too, if you have enough money, financial wisdom, whatever that is, you can hire just about everything else. The question, though, is how should we allow there to be leadership intelligence, creative intelligence, executive intelligence, emotional intelligence, or should we be more stricter constructionists? I guess I draw the line two ways. One, I think intelligence basically should be about computing power. So the more I think that something has to do with computation, and financial may have to do with computation, the more I think it probably, it's not a misuse of the term. I don't think morality has much to do with computation. I might want to argue with some of the teaching fellows about that. I think it has a lot more to do with values. And the objection I have to emotional intelligence is not so much the use of the term, particularly by Peter Salve and Jack Meyer, who actually coined the phrase, Danny Goldman didn't, but rather that often people cross the line between description and prescription. Part of the time we're talking about computing, namely how well can you deal with information about other people or about yourself, and to me that's certainly an intelligence. But sometimes we're talking about the kind of person you should be, you know, like be a nice bus driver, which is Danny Goldman's favorite opening example in the book. And I think when you cross the line from describing to saying what you value, what kind of person you want someone to be, then you're no longer talking about computing, you're talking about something else. So those are the things I would keep in mind as we talk about the kind of the inflation of the notion of intelligence. It's great to go beyond IQ and G and language and logic, but that doesn't mean you should take everything in the kitchen sink about the kitchen sink and call it intelligence. How to assess? Remember, this is ISENC again. And people like ISENC and Arthur Jensen, a man well known to education, say, let's get rid of these paper and pencil tests. Let's get rid of these hands-on clinical interviews. Jensen says, let's just look at reaction time, how quickly you press the button when there's a sequence of lights. And ISENC says, let's just look at brain waves altogether. And Robert Plowman, a very distinguished behavioral geneticist, says, let's just look at the genes. This is like Ponce de Leon looking for the fountain of youth. Will we ever be able to find the ultimate site for what intelligence really is, the real gene, the real part of the brain, the ultimate question? You know, wouldn't it be great if college admissions could be decided in just one question? If you could answer that question, like the riddle of the Sphinx, that you can go to Harvard. A lot of money is going to be spent on this. It's a very appealing idea, but I think it's a will-o'-the-wisp. I think it's a fool's errand. I think that intelligence is always going to be an interaction between intellectual potential, what's available in the culture, and what people are motivated to work on, and what they get rewarded to work on. It's going to be much more complicated. And so I think that rather than looking for this pure essence, which may not exist, in what I was calling before the dipstick view of intelligence, I think instead we ought to say, what are the kind of intellectual performances that we value? And let's come up with the most accurate simulations we can of those things we value. So if we want to know whether a person can lead, and we can't watch them lead, let's create a computer-based simulation of virtual reality where they have to lead and they have to respond to another person or to a computer program based on another person. If we want to know how a person can write, the radical idea, let's have them write. Let's give them some topics to write, and let's have some good literary types evaluate their writing. So this is assessment in context. And it's saying, let's look at what's really important, and let's look at it directly as we can. Let's look at it wholesale. Let's not look at it retail. Let's not ask if people can recite numbers backwards because we thought it might be relevant to whether they can learn something unfamiliar. Let's say they can learn something unfamiliar, and especially something that they're motivated to learn. The closest we've come to this in our own work at Project Zero has been to look at what's called alternative or authentic assessment, and going very far away from standardized multiple choice tests. We've looked at exhibitions, portfolios, performance-based exams, and other kinds of much more rounded, much more contextual instruments. We also had an ambitious project. It was a 10-year project called Project Spectrum, which was an effort to assess in context the intelligences of very young kids, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 7 years of age. And we did this by creating a very rich environment, an environment which was as much like a children's museum as like a classroom, and having lots of very inviting materials. Stuff wasn't put into the rooms unless kids liked to play with it. And we used the kids' interactions with these materials to tell us something about their profile or spectrum of intelligences at that historical moment. So we had them play musical instruments. These are Montessori bells. We had them take apart and put together household objects. By the way, this is a very good way to assess the teachers' intelligences, because many teachers think that kids are stupid, and then they find out the kids can do this better than the teachers, and this shakes up the teachers' categorization. What intelligence is involved in taking apart and putting together instruments? Probably a bunch of intelligences, probably bodily, kinesthetic, and spatial, and logical, mathematical, but not particularly linguistic or musical or existential or the personal intelligence. In fact, autistic kids who are, alas, interpersonally very obtuse are often very good at assembling and taking apart the objects. We looked at kids' ability to build something out of 3D and then tell stories about it, and that let us look at their linguistic and their imaginative abilities. We call this a naturalist corner, where kids were given all sorts of living specimens and asked to group them and to distinguish from them and so on. We gave kids lots of games to play, and this not only told us about their mathematical abilities, but also about their understanding of other people. Until the age of 4 or so, it's actually a sign of interpersonal intelligence to cheat, because it shows that you understand that other people are not privy to all the information that you are. We'll talk about this when we talk about theory of mind, if we haven't already talked about it. After the age of 4, we tend to discourage cheating, except in certain political and business arenas. But these games give us a lot of information about the interpersonal and the mathematical abilities of kids. And in a very sensitive instrument, we ask kids to reconstruct the 3D big classroom in miniature. And this gives us information about the spatial abilities of kids. But also we have on pieces of wood photographs of all the kids and adults in the classroom. And we use this as an unobtrusive measure of interpersonal intelligence. We ask the kids who plays with whom, who likes whom, who does what usually, who was doing what yesterday. And their ability to do this shows us how much information they pick up about the human factor. Now, this is at best a rough and ready way of getting at kids' intelligences. And I always say if kids are doing fine, there's no purpose even to do any assessing at all. But if kids are having problems and you can observe kids over a period of time in a very rich environment like this, you can come up with a pretty good picture of what their intellectual strengths and weaknesses are. And then the question, of course, is how do you use that educationally? I see no point in classifying kids unless you're going to use the information. And one of my major criticisms of psychology is that we spend much too much time classifying kids in terms of intelligence and personality and temperament, and not nearly enough time saying, given this particular picture, what do we do with kids to help them be productive human beings? So we try to push that as well. I'm going to run through these quickly because you can stop the tape and look at it as much as you want. These are examples of the tasks which we've used in Spectrum to look at various intelligences. And we also found it necessary to look at working styles, because we found that a lot of the differences among kids were not just in intellectual strength, but also in styles. And here's where we made the discovery that a child might be very confident in one domain using one intelligence and not another domain. Confidence isn't something you just wear everywhere. Just like these many studies which measure self-esteem in kids are very dangerous unless the self-esteem is attached to something. And self-esteem means that you feel good about yourself because you're able to do something, not because somebody gave you a lot of practice in saying, I'm great, which is probably better than saying I'm awful. But if your grade is unattached to anything, it's kind of a hollow claim. What happens to multiple intelligences as they get older? Well, let me first talk a bit about what happens to psychometric intelligence, G, as you get older, because it's quite depressing if you are a person who would like to believe in environment. And that is because when you're very young, your intelligence is not predictable. But by the time you're 5 or 6, about half of your intelligence can be predicted by who your biological parents were. When you get to be adolescent, that's when you're most unlike your biological parents, and that's when you have the greatest latitude in what your IQ is. But as you get older and older and older, your intelligence gets more and more like your parents. So by the time you're 80 or 90, your psychometric intelligence is as close to that of your biological parents as they will ever be. Now, I love my parents, and I'm very happy to have the minds they do, but I would also like to think I have somewhat more to say about this than just kind of having waited to age 80 to find out what I was going to do. So, what's there to say about this? Well, the first thing to say about this is that it may be confounded with health. With how generally healthy you are, which obviously has something to do with your biological parents, may also have something to say about the energy you have and how much energy you're going to put in taking tests and, you know, whether you have various kinds of psychological problems or so on. So there's a confound with health here, which I think is important to point out. The second thing to point out is that intelligence measures are pretty, they're pretty narrow, and the kind of things you're looking at, like, you know, how well you can remember numbers, are not the sort of things that people particularly become expert in life. What that correlation tells you nothing about is whether you can become good at something. I mean, I became a decent pianist and a decent writer. My parents didn't do either. They had no education. If you looked at them, I'd say, gee, I could never become a writer or a pianist, but it's because they didn't bother to develop that ability. Maybe they had the potential, but it's moot because nobody measured that potential when they were young. So expertise in what you accomplish in the world is very different from whether you maintain the same genetic intelligence as your parents. Happily, you don't have to worry about G when it comes to multiple intelligences because we're not asking that kind of question. My own belief is that when kids are very young, it's very easy to watch the intelligences at work because kids wear their minds on their sleeves. You watch them in a science museum or children's museum, you can see what intelligence they're doing. In classes, for the most part, if people aren't sleeping, they're sort of sitting there and occasionally blinking or maybe moving a mouse or a paper, so you can't really tell whether anything's going on. But my notion is that our intelligences are very active, but they're underground. We can't really see them. They're going on in the mind-brain, and we would need to have more invasive techniques to find out what kind of intellectual capacities are really being used. I also believe, and this is very counter to what I just said about G and age 80, that if anything, the older we get, the more we represent things in a very highly personal way. That is, we put together our own intelligences or our own neural networks or whatever figure you want to use in ways which reflect our own experiences, our own goals, and so on. And so our minds are probably less similar to those of other people the older we get, rather than becoming more similar. And we can put the parental point here in parentheses. And certainly from the point of view of interpersonal intelligence, it's extremely important to know what's idiosyncratic about your mind, how you learn, and as parents and teachers, not to project that onto others, because they may learn in very different kinds of ways. A final point on this overhead is that the more we know about our own personal representations, and particularly their weaknesses, the more we can make use of other things to help us. Computers and distance learning can be prosthetics. They can be hand-fashioned to build perfectly on what we're good and bad in. Moreover, because they are intelligent systems, because they can learn, they can actually make use of what worked or didn't work in the N-1 trial. So in the N or the N+1 trial, they can be even better nuanced. Every day I get an an invitation from some startup called smart.com or brain.com or mi.com to figure out how to use MI ideas to create the ultimately brilliant set of computer programs which is going to make everybody into Einstein. I've simplified my life by not bothering to answer those requests anymore, but I do believe the people who really understand these intellectual profiles deeply, who understand what has to be learned deeply, disciplines, domains, and so on, and who can intercalate them and make learning programs, will have a very attractive business. And if any of you want to quit school and go do that now, I'll take 10% of what you do. Just kidding. Final point. I'm very interested in intelligence, and you know that, and I've written about it and gotten to many arguments about it. But built in my work on intelligence, I have moved over the years into studies of creativity and leadership, both of which build on my approach to intelligence. They're both very pluralistic views, but they aren't in any sense equivalent to the work in intelligence. And most recently, with Bill Damon and Mike Csikszentmihalyi and many other colleagues at Harvard and Stanford University and Claremont Graduate University, we've been looking at the sense of responsibility, of ethics, of morality in people who are doing cutting-edge work in various domains. That's clearly another lecture, not one I'm going to give today, but I want to make a couple of points. First of all, I like to quote Ralph Waldo Emerson, Harvard College class of 1821, I believe. You can look it up. Who said, character is more important than intellect. I think the important point here is I don't think we need smarter people in this world. I don't even think we need more people who are smart in any definition. I think we need more people who have good character, and particularly with all of the breakthroughs in nanotechnology and robotics and the Human Genome Project winding down and so on. It's people who will know how to use this stuff well and wisely and judiciously and not squander it, which I think are going to be much more at a premium than another person with 150 IQ. Mensa doesn't need more members, but maybe the World Conscience Society does. In our own work, we've been looking at five different kinds of responsibility of good work. Good work is work that is an expert quality. That's an intellectual performance, but it's also work that's responsible, work that takes into account its implications. Even if the bell curve were a good work scientifically, which I don't believe it is, I think it's also irresponsible work, and it's not a work. It's a work that I would not have been proud to have written. And we look at five kinds of responsibility to self, selfish as well as selfless, because all of us are a blend of this, of both motivations. Responsibility to others, to family, to friends, to peers, colleagues. Responsibility to institutions. Except for artists, almost all of us belong to institutions. You are an institution now, Harvard Graduate School of Education at Harvard University. Most of you come from schools or other institutions will go back to them. What are your responsibilities to those institutions? What are your responsibilities to your chosen profession, whether it's teaching or medicine or journalism or whatever? What does it mean to be a good teacher, a good journalist? And finally, what are your responsibilities to the wider world, people who will come after you, subsequent generations, the health of the planet, the health of the community? Now, anybody who thought about these things all the time would go nuts. It's like the centipede problem. Once the centipede tried to figure out how he moved, he was forever afterwards paralyzed. But people who are good workers are people who, from time to time, both consciously and unconsciously, are monitoring these responsibilities. And they are people who, I would say, are on the road to good character, though, of course, you could make bad choices about these responsibilities. And that brings me to the last and concluding slide, which is that as cognitive developmentalists interested in education, we need to keep in mind three different kinds of intelligence. The kind that Piaget was interested in was what is the nature of intelligence such that it applies to all of life, Piaget the biologist, and as it applies to human being. Piaget, the study student of the four stages and sensory motor intelligence and all that sort of stuff. So Piaget was completely uninterested in individual differences. He wanted to know what human cognition was like subspecies aeternitas. Then, from Binet until now, and I would include myself in these ranks, people were interested in intelligence as an individual difference. Hernstein and Murray think there's just one bell curve, and the only individual difference of interest is are you at 120 or at 85. But I'm interested in many kinds of intelligences and many blends, and I have no commitment to the statement they can't be changed. I'm sure they can be and will be. And then the issue of intelligence, which gets closer to questions of responsibility, where he's making the proper decision, the intelligent decision, the wise decision, the judicious decision. They're not all the same, but they're all in the same ballpark. And that's not a question of how good a computer you have inside your head. It's a question of goals and values. And of course, you can have foolish goals and values, and I suppose you could be intelligent if you are trying to meet those foolish goals and values, but once you begin to bring in the goals and values of other people, then they can say, boy, that guy's pretty stupid, even though he doesn't realize he's being pretty stupid. So, that's it on intelligence for today. That was...